Strange studies of strange stories.
The year was 2081, and everybody was finally equal. They weren't only equal before God and the law. They were equal every which way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anybody else. Nobody was stronger or quicker than anybody else. All this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th Amendments to the Constitution, and to the unceasing vigilance of agents of the United States Handicapper General. Some things about living still weren't quite right, though. April, for instance, still drove people crazy by not being springtime. And it was in that clammy month that the HG men took George and Hazel Bergeron's 14-year-old son, Harrison, away. It was tragic, all right, but George and Hazel couldn't think about it very hard. Hazel had a perfectly average intelligence, which meant she couldn't think about anything except in short bursts. And George, while his intelligence was way above normal, had a little mental handicap radio in his ear. He was required by law to wear it at all times. It was tuned to a government transmitter. Every 20 seconds or so, the transmitter would send out some sharp noise to keep people like George from taking unfair advantage of their brains.
That's the somewhat dubious opening from Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s Harrison Bergeron. We're going to discuss it here on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. Why is this raising red flags for me? I'm Chris Lackey, and I'm not sure about this.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer, and I'm down for it. Oh. I've read this story twice. I've had two entirely different reactions, so I'm excited to talk about it.
Who was that reader?
Why, that was Eric Peabody joining us once again. Eric's part of the team that brings you this show each and every week with his smooth audio expertise. Oh, yeah. When he saw that we had this story on the schedule, he wrote us and said, Harrison Bergeron is a story that impacted me pretty heavily back in high school when I read it, and I'd be stoked to narrate it. Eric, you had me at stoked.
Yeah.
And we're stoked. Because Eric is a top-notch reader, what I like to call a narrateur. He's the reader for a horror-themed audio storytelling podcast spun off from Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. You know it. You love it. It's the Horror Hill Podcast. It features the handpicked work of dozens of accomplished, independent, and previously published contributing authors. Eric takes those stories and he polishes them up with his sweet voice, just like he does with our audio. By the way, he could do that for your project as well if you're doing an audio project. Check out Viking Guitar Productions. He's a sound mixing professor, and I got more plugs than a surge suppressor. Let's get into this author.
Wow. I'm a big fan of Kurt Vonnegut. I love Breakfast of Champions and Slaughterhouse-Five. I've never read any of his short stories, though.
Vonnegut definitely loved the pulps, and we've referenced the ludicrous concepts of his science fiction writer character, Kilgore Trout, lots of times on the show, especially when we covered Theodore Sturgeon, on whom he's loosely based. But we haven't actually covered Vonnegut himself yet. What are the basic facts here?
Kurt Vonnegut Jr. was born in Indianapolis, Indiana in 1922. He was born to an American-German family, but they downplayed their heritage due to the anti-German sentiments around the First World War.
Kurt, do not go outside with those lederhosen on, I told you!
They went to college at Cornell and majored in biochemistry. He wrote for the university newspaper and then became an editor. At the start of World War II, Vonnegut was put on academic probation for bad grades and a satirical article he published in the school newspaper. He dropped out. Instead of being drafted, however, he enlisted. Mm. While in basic training, Vonnegut's mother committed suicide, which was horrible and shocking to me. I didn't know about that. 3 months later, he was sent to Europe as a scout in the 106th Infantry Division. He fought in the Battle of the Bulge in 1944.
Wow.
Just nuts. He was captured with 50 other soldiers and put into a prison camp in Dresden. And on February 13th, 1945, Dresden was firebombed by the Allied forces, killing 25,000 civilians. Vonnegut and some of his fellow prisoners took refuge in the meat locker at that prison camp. He's quoted as saying, "With cadavers hanging all around. When we came up, the city was gone. They burnt the whole damn town down." They were put to work soon after by the surviving Germans to help with the cleanup. And then by May, they were released back into American custody. A lot of that experience is part of a big part of his novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, which came out in 1969.
I recently read the graphic novel version of that book. His foreword, where he says he was one of the only beneficiaries of the firebombing of Dresden, that, you know, by writing the successful book, he had made X amount of money from each victim.
Yeah.
It is a real gut punch of an opening that swept me right through so many emotions in that book.
Yeah.
potently emotional book.
Vonnegut's first novel, Player Piano, was published in 1952. Some of his other well-known books include Cat's Cradle, 1963, and Breakfast of Champions, 1973. Vonnegut died in New York City in 2007 at the age of 84.
We're going to do two of his stories today. They are examples, I thought, of speculative fiction in which a concept is pushed to a limit, sometimes to absurd effect. We've seen it before. It's a common tactic in the genre. It usually never fails to create estrangement, if done right, thereby prompting discussion. Let's summarize these tales, and then we'll do as prompted and discuss.
The first story of his that we are tackling is called Harrison Bergeron. It was published in the October 1961 issue of The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. It's set in the distant future of 2081. Society has been made equal, not by elevating those with disadvantages, but by hindering people physically and mentally. George and Hazel Bergeron's 14-year-old son was recently taken away by the government. Hazel is of average intelligence. George is as well, but not naturally. He has a radio transmitter put into his ear to keep him distracted. Without this handicapping device, he would be quite clever.
Of course, right away, I'm thinking about smartphones like any cranky old dude. I've had almost all of my good ideas while daydreaming. Phones short-circuit that process because if I have downtime, every 20 seconds, I'm looking at an email or reading an article.
Yeah.
Stop coming after my daydreams, cell phones.
The point here is, though, that they don't worry about their son too much because of their limited mental capacities.
They can't even really feel their emotions because of this handicapping. It's taken to a really absurd length. And we're not exactly sure why the son has been taken at this point. We can assume he was maybe too intelligent or otherwise talented and had to be done away with.
This society also has people constantly watching television. So in the 1960s, early 1960s, TV is definitely going up and up and up, and more people are watching television, so I can see that.
Yeah. If you were of Vonnegut's generation, you would be having the same observation about television that I'm having. You know, I watched a change happen, but I've always had television.
Yeah.
His generation watched that change happen. So I'm sure we're equally like, oh, it's ruining everybody.
It's definitely changing things.
Yeah.
As the story begins, George and Hazel are watching ballerinas dance. The ballerinas are really no better than anybody else, since if they were better than other people, that would make people feel bad. So they have weights tied to their legs, and since they're pretty, they are forced to wear masks to hide their beauty.
It's such an absurd, pretty funny image to start on, of these people weighed down with masks trying to do some clunky form of ballet. It certainly lets you know this is Voltaire-esque absurdity satire.
Sure. George mentions that his wife looks a little like the handicapper general. I love that.
Yeah.
A woman named Diana Moon Glampers. She enforces the rules of fairness. We find out that George is also physically adept, so he has to wear weights to make him more normal. And I'm doing air quotes when I say that. Hazel suggests that he rest and take them off for a bit, but if he's caught, he will be fined and placed in jail, so he doesn't.
I'm a big fan of the last-minute Halloween costume, and I think this time I'm going to just carry two little five-pound dumbbells around and be like, I'm George from Harrison Bergeron. I'm too fast, so I got to be weighed down. People will be like, oh, now that you explain it, I get it.
A report comes in from the television. The reporter has a speech impediment, or at least employs a speech impediment to keep things fair. I'm not sure. He can barely get anything out, so the ballerina takes over reading the report. It says, Harrison Bergeron, age 14, has just escaped jail where he was held on suspicion of plotting to overthrow the government. He is a genius and an athlete, is under-handicapped, and should be regarded as extremely dangerous.
His description is pretty funny. He's 7 feet tall. They can't really do anything about that. But the rest of Harrison's appearance was Halloween and hardware. Nobody had ever borne heavier handicaps. Instead of little ear radio for a mental handicap, he wore a tremendous pair of earphones and spectacles with thick, wavy lenses. The spectacles were intended to make him not only half blind, but to give him wanging headaches besides. Scrap metal was hung all over him. Harrison carried 300 pounds. And to offset his good looks, the HG men require that he wear at all times a red rubber ball for a nose, keep his eyebrows shaved off, and cover his even white teeth with black caps at snaggletooth random. I'm thinking, and that's what they're showing on the TV to let you know he's escaped, right? Like,
right.
How are they going to find this guy if they only know him from his disguise? He could just put on a different disguise. It's so funny. But then there's some kind of consternation within the studio. Just as they're warning people of Harrison, he comes busting in.
Yes. George and Hazel are shocked Everyone is terrified of him in the studio.
Harrison takes over the news desk.
"I am the Emperor," cried Harrison. "Do you hear? I am the Emperor. Everybody must do what I say at once." He stamped his foot and the studio shook. "Even as I stand here," he bellowed, "crippled, hobbled, sickened, I am a greater ruler than any man who has ever lived. Now watch me become what I can become." Harrison removes all of his weights from his body and his rubber nose that he wears on his face, and he's free. He can be himself completely. He declares that he's going to need an empress, and he asks for a volunteer. One of the ballerinas stands up. He takes the radio out of her ear, the weights off of her body, and the mask off her face. They embrace, and Harrison tells the band to play music. They obey. Harrison and the ballerina begin to dance, but then he commands the band, because, of course, they've got to be hampered, to throw off all of their shackles and play as good as they can, play their best, and they do. Then there is an explosion. Diana Moon Glampers, handicapper general, swings into the studio, and she blasts Harrison and the ballerina with a shotgun, killing them dead instantly. This is rad on a couple levels, that this woman, I assumed was a bureaucrat,
yeah,
actually goes out, does some rappelling.
She's like an action hero.
Yeah, and just shoots these people, just kills them dead.
Yeah, does a John Wick move.
And right as that happens, the Bergeron's TV burns out.
Hazel turned to comment about the blackout to George, but George had gone into the kitchen for a can of beer. George came back in with the beer, paused while a handicap signal shook him up, and then he sat down again. "You've been crying," he said to Hazel. "Yup," she said. "What about?" he said. "I forget," she said. "Something real sad on television." "What was it?" he said. "It's all kind of mixed up in my mind," said Hazel. "Forget sad things," said George. "I always do," said Hazel. "That's my girl," said George. He winced. There was the sound of a riveting gun in his head. "Gee, I could tell that one was a doozy," said Hazel. "You can say that again," said George. "Gee," said Hazel, "I could tell that one was a doozy."
And that's the end of the story?
That's the end. I find this very odd, this story, for Vonnegut. Vonnegut, in a letter, suggested that Harrison Bergeron might have sprung from his envy and self-pity as a high school misfit.
Yeah, I could see that.
And for me, it feels out of place compared to most of Vonnegut's other stories, except for his novel, The Sirens of Titan, which came out in 1959. Mm-hmm. And this story actually borrows quite a bit from that. There's a planet of handicapped people.
Oh, really?
In that. Yeah, yeah. Now, he was very open socialist during his life.
Uh-huh.
But the story feels to have more of a libertarian ideology to it. In fact, in 2019, this story was given the Prometheus Hall of Fame Award by the Libertarian Futurist Society.
Oh, okay.
So
you're not the only one?
Yeah, yeah. I think that it's libertarian-like. Mm-hmm. Now, the story feels off to me because I feel like it's saying that our society is hampering people in order to make things fair in slight ways, then of course takes it to that extreme place, showing how wrong that would be. But my personal worldview doesn't quite align with the idea of that. Mm-hmm. And I feel that people with skill and talent are usually doing just fine, and their skills and talents are encouraged. And of course, sometimes plundered by others. You know, people take advantage of talented people and make money off of them.
Yeah, stuff. Definitely. But I know what you're saying. My first reading of it was more in line with that. And my second reading, too. I mean, I got the impression that it was a cranky story, maybe.
Like, sometimes cranky, yeah.
Bradbury stories are like cranky reactions to changing technology. And then you think, well, maybe he slippery sloped that a little too much. Mm. This one does it on purpose, though. And who knows if maybe he got set off by some government or educational effort to promote fairness that was an overreach, maybe. Or maybe it was prompted by a defensive individualism he felt he needed to make, if it's kind of based on how he felt as a high school misfit. But on this reread, I got more into the idea that it's a funny send-up of slippery slope arguments in general, because it's just so totally absurd.
Hmm.
And I think back to, you know, I wrote an article about gay marriage for the Simon years ago,
yeah,
when it was a topic du jour. And my article presented that, you know, in a nutshell, that if we have gay marriage, it's going to lead to a society of dog men attacking the country. It went to a really absurd place.
Mm-hmm.
And I was arguing against gay marriage. It went to that absurd place to prove a point. But that was a sign to me. I wouldn't want somebody to think I got stirred up by the issue. Somebody said, write about this, and I did. Mm-hmm. And then saw it mistaken by people.
Yeah.
either who like somebody used it in support of their anti-gay marriage paper. I had to get a hold of their professor and say, fail this fool. Because it's not what I meant.
They're missing the point entirely.
The point. But I was really in that one as well, aside from lampooning that it was a stupid thing, because I'm obviously pro-gay marriage. It's just marriage, you know. But I think that I could see in the effort of doing that satire, people can take all sorts of things out of it. It becomes inscrutable what the author really means, a little bit. But I thought that this, on my reread this time, I felt like it was more about slippery slope arguments in general.
Yeah.
That said, I understand your reaction to the core issue, but it is a complex issue. You know, when does making things fair damage those who are exceptional? And when is it people thinking that they're being damaged when things are just getting more equal? Right. I think the Pixar movie, The Incredibles, actually goes after this same question in a way. The kid is super fast and he's on the track team, but he's got to go slow to be like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And this is his primary challenge in life. Socially, some people feel angry when government gives a leg up to a section of society based on a narrow criteria, a characteristic that marks them as underprivileged, whether that's race, income, sexuality, etc. Because people are more than just a few criteria. It's more complex than that. Mm. You might be a white man who's disadvantaged in many other ways that just aren't being accounted for. And that's what makes you angry about this policy or that policy. Mm. At the same time, I had a friend who used to say equality feels like oppression to the privileged, right?
Yep. The only people that come to mind for me that might feel handicapped, like the people in the story are handicapped, are people that have a lot of money and don't want to pay taxes. And I've heard a few libertarians declare tax is theft and taxes are unfair because I earned this money. And who are you to say what I should do with it or what it should be spent on?
Yeah.
And their accumulation of wealth is being handicapped to help people who are not as good at making money as they are.
Right. Like wealth redistribution.
Yes. Yeah. Now, my response to that has always been, where did your money come from? Did you earn it without the help of a functioning society? Taxes build roads, pay for schools, give us a military and a police force. Sure, it's not perfect, but the government, it creates a set of rules that everybody can play by to keep things fair-ish. And how well it does that, it depends on the government and what you want out of it as a society as well.
Right. Like, you might not like what it's doing, but we do need this. Blowing it up is certainly not the proper response. You need to continue to try to get in the people that will do closer aligned with what your values are.
Yeah. Exactly. It made me think about this article that I read by Douglas Rushkoff. It was about a super rich guy conference. And he was there to talk about future technology and how it's going to affect things. And he thought he was going to do a talk in front of the, you know, big auditorium full of people.
Yeah.
And when he got there, it was a small room with five dudes in there who were these super rich guys.
Yeah.
And he's in the article, he says, what did they want to know? How do I maintain authority over my security force after the event?
Oh, no.
Now, the event means the collapse of society or the apocalypse.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so it's like these, because this is something a lot of billionaires, I shouldn't say a lot, I don't know how many, but some billionaires have made these bunkers or these facilities to survive, you know, a nuclear war or zombie apocalypse.
Spend that money somehow, sure.
Now, here's a quote from the article. This single question occupied us for the rest of the hour. They knew armed guards would be required to protect their compounds from angry mobs, but how would they pay the guards once money was worthless? What would stop the guards from choosing their own leaders? The billionaires considered using special combination locks on the food supply that only they knew, or making guards wear disciplinary collars of some kind in return for their survival.
They're all Dr. Evils.
It's true. Or by maybe building a robot to serve as guards and workers if that technology could be developed in time. So they're hoping that maybe technology will allow them to have robots to protect them and that
Because they're like, I can't, you would say trust blood only, but they can't even trust their own families. Trust oil, the robots. Those are the only reliable servants.
The wrong-headed thinking of the whole thing, it's just so nuts to me, because the only reason they could ever be billionaires is because society allowed them to be billionaires. And if society goes away, you're not a billionaire anymore. You're just a guy.
Yeah.
The whole infrastructure of a society is needed. You know, you need roads and farmers and people that can build things and repair things. And if without that stuff, you've got nothing. In a very small amount of time, it would all fall apart. But in this story, I don't really know what it's trying to say. Maybe you're right. Maybe it is about if people use slippery slope arguments that they are obviously ultimately ridiculous and don't really prove anything.
Well, yes. And I don't need to simplify it to that, though, either. Part of the reason it's a good story is because by employing, I mean, the story employs the slippery slope tactic, takes it to an absurd place and says this really happened. But along the way, because of that estrangement it creates, it makes you think about all the stuff you just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why it's a sticky story, because these are hard things to talk about. They bring up lots of emotions, and you don't want to set somebody off if they have a different political alignment than you.
Sure.
But I do think that actually, more than that, the core thing that it's getting at is that the question of should or shouldn't be, we can debate that all day, but it's the administration that is, you know, who does it? You know, we all say they should do this and they should do that.
Oh, right.
And they should just get it done. Who's they and how? You know, those are the issues that get sidelined. And politics very rarely address how government is administrated.
Mm-hmm.
The way that we perceive it, it's more of a sports narrative. We don't talk about policy. There's this pooled money that's created via our taxes, as you said. Mm-hmm. The government is essentially trying to figure out how to spend that money. But politicians, they're motivated by getting your vote. You could spend your vote as a means of grading the performance of a politician or of that politician's goals and plans for achieving them. If they haven't been in office yet, that means paying attention to understanding. The other way that you can spend your vote is to declare allegiance culturally. This is the group that I identify with. This is my team. And that's kind of a simpler decision to make.
Yeah.
And so for the politician to get that vote, that allegiance vote, they don't have to have solutions. They just have to raise issues. And if you share those issues, those fears, then the voter says, those are the same things I'm worried about. That's my team. I declare allegiance. Here's my vote.
Yeah.
So whether the problem is immigrants or the problem is billionaires, that's how you figure out who you're voting for. But whether they can do that job or not, you know, it's natural to be skeptical that politicians are going to be any good at it, considered that that's all they really spend their time doing. There's no simple solution, and it's really hard to create them because they always affect somebody negatively.
Sure.
No matter what.
Yeah.
Even if it's a small amount of people. So on my second reading, I really felt like the story is attacking that core concept in a way. Every decision by a ruler or government has unexpected effects. Sometimes we have the best intentions, but in trying to simplify things in order to effectuate a change, all of these ludicrous things start happening, and then it's whack-a-mole, and then that becomes the total bureaucratic nonsense of governance.
Right, right.
And it obviously happens in schools when we're dealing with tracking children, where we have to try to come up with a policy. Do we keep the gifted, quote-unquote gifted kids or the smarter kids, you know, in their own classes, or do we put everybody together to get them more socially adept?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a hard question.
Yeah.
And you can see both sides of it. The issues are easier to talk about than the solutions. And I felt like maybe that's what this story is about.
Could be. That gets us into our next story. To be or not to be. First published in the January 1962 issue of If Worlds of Science Fiction.
It's expressed numerically, that title.
Mm-hmm.
2BR02B. The zero is meant to be not.
Not.
It's a stretch. When I read that title the first time, I'm looking at it and thinking two bedroom, oh, two baths or two bro, two B, which sounds like a category of adult film, maybe. Eric, take it away.
Everything was perfectly swell. There were no prisons, no slums, no insane asylums, no cripples, no poverty, no wars. All diseases were conquered. So was old age. Death, barring accidents, was an adventure for volunteers. The population of the United States was stabilized at 40 million souls. One bright morning in the Chicago Lying-In Hospital, a man named Edward K. Wheeling Jr. waited for his wife to give birth. He was the only man waiting. Not many people were born a day anymore. Wheeling was 56, a mere stripling in a population whose average age was 129. X-rays had revealed that his wife was going to have triplets. The children would be his first.
So we have a society where disease is cured as well as aging. People are not dying. So how do we deal with this? Will there be unexpected consequences?
Mm-hmm.
We start with this guy, Ed Welling, who's young at 56. I like the sound of that.
Yeah, me too. Welling's wife is about to have a baby. There is an older man, 200 years-ish, painting a mural. He's only old-looking because he aged before they found a cure for aging.
It can't turn back time. That's a little vampiric. You're stuck at the age you were when the change happened.
Yeah.
A hospital orderly comes down the hall, and he's singing a popular song, the lyrics of which Vonnegut just made up for the story. And the lyrics are actually in here. What do you think it sounds like?
If you don't like my kisses, honey, what will I do? I'll go see a girl in purple, kiss the sad world toodaloo. If you don't want my loving, why should I take up all this space? I'll go off this planet, let some sweet baby have my place.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Sight read, too.
It was in my heart.
Thank you for doing that. I really did spring it on him.
This orderly walking by admires the old painter's work. The painter says it's called The Happy Garden of Life. One of the figures in the painting is Dr. Hitz, chief obstetrician at the hospital, and most of the people in the mural will be based off of staff at the hospital and the offices of the Federal Bureau of Termination. The old man says it's all BS. Life is more like this drop cloth that's got paint spilled all over it than it is this mural. And the orderly says, if you don't like it, call the number.
That number was 2BR02B. And then it actually explains in the text that the zero is pronounced not. So to be or not to be is how you're supposed to read it, like the famous line in Hamlet.
It's a phone number to schedule one's suicide.
It was the telephone number of an institution whose fanciful sobriquets included Automat, Birdland, Cannery, Catbox, Delouser, Easy Go, Goodbye Mother, Happy Hooligan, Kiss Me Quick, Lucky Pierre. Where's Lucky Pierre come from?
I don't know.
Sheep Dip, Weep No More, and Why Worry?
The old man says, if I'm going to kill myself, I'm not going to go do it in the Sheep Dip. A sheep dip is one of the things I learned moving out here in Yorkshire. It's like delousing. You basically have a sheep go through this big trough of chemicals to kill off all of their parasites and bacteria and things like that.
I thought it was sheep's eating dip.
I wish. The orderly admonishes him for this idea of killing himself out in the public because then somebody would have to clean up your mess. And that's not cool.
This is some dark stuff, man. Weirdly a more enjoyable read than the last story.
Yeah.
Even though it's about darker stuff in a way. Well, I guess not. They had their kid taken away from them at the beginning of the last story. What am I talking about?
Yeah.
But this is a little like the suicide chambers in the Robert Chambers stories that we covered, you know, way back.
After the orderly leaves, a very stern woman arrives. She tells the painter that she's come to pose for the painting. Her name is Leora Duncan, and she's with the Federal Bureau of Termination.
The woman had a lot of facial hair, an unmistakable mustache, in fact. A curious thing about gas chamber hostesses was that no matter how lovely and feminine they were when recruited, they all sprouted mustaches within 5 years or so. Why?
What is that about? I don't understand.
Oh, you didn't know either? I thought I was just like not getting something.
No, it was weird.
Somebody please explain that to us.
Yeah, I don't get it. The painter asks her to pick one of the faceless forms in the mural to have her likeness. She's not very interested until he suggests the woman carrying dried stalks for a trash burner. She doesn't like that. She's not a disposal person. He then points to the figure next to Dr. Hitz, and she's shocked that she should get such an honored position. Dr. Hitz was the first to set up the euthanasia chamber in Chicago. The painter suggests having her sawing off a limb of a tree in the painting. She says, that is kind of like what I do. She was demure about what she did. What she did was make people comfortable while she killed them. Just then, the white-haired Dr. Hitz comes in and makes a joke about Leora being in the wrong place. This is for people coming in, not going out, huh? The doctor gives Duncan the news. Triplets have been born. Oh, boy. She asks if they have three volunteers, but he says they only have one and they're looking for two more.
That's where we get to the real concept here, the concept behind the concept. Mm-hmm. Somebody has to die for somebody to be born. You don't get that population stabilization mentioned in the opening paragraph without that policy. You know, otherwise you start getting a millennium situation. And with triplets... It doesn't look like Dad has the credit he needs to pull this off.
Mm-hmm.
They just phoned me that your triplets have been born, said Dr. Hitz. They're all fine, and so is the mother. I'm on my way in to see them now. Hooray, said Welling emptily. Well, you don't sound very happy, said Dr. Hitz. What man in my shoes wouldn't be happy? He gestured with his hands to symbolize carefree simplicity. All I have to do is pick out which one of the triplets is going to live, then deliver my maternal grandfather to the happy hooligan. And come back here with a receipt.
Dr. Hitz asks if he wants to go back to an overpopulated Earth. Welling says, of course not.
In the year 2000, said Dr. Hitz, before scientists stepped in and laid down the law, there wasn't even enough drinking water to go around, and nothing to eat but seaweed. And still people insisted on their right to reproduce like jackrabbits, and their right, if possible, to live forever.
It says here, this child of yours, whichever one you decide to keep, Mr. Welling, he or she is going to live on a happy, roomy, clean, rich planet thanks to the population control, in a garden like that mural there. 2 centuries ago, when I was a young man, it was a hell nobody thought could last another 20 years. Now centuries of peace and plenty stretch before us as far as the imagination cares to travel.
Well, he makes a good point, so I imagine the father will accept his logic.
No! Welling pulls out a gun and shoots Dr. Hitz dead. And then Leora, too. Boom, dead. And then Welling shoots himself, making room for all three of his kids, and his grandfather doesn't have to be killed. Nobody comes running, strangely. The painter's the only one that's left there on his ladder.
Yeah, looking at the carnage, which has turned out to be a little like his paint-splattered drop cloth. Which was my observation, by the way. Vonnegut didn't point it out. I made the connection myself, sir.
Aw, I'm proud of you.
Very proud of myself. Thank you.
It says here, the painter pondered the mournful puzzle of life demanding to be born and, once born, demanding to be fruitful, to multiply and live as long as possible, to do all of that on a very small planet that would have to last forever. All the answers that the painter could think of were grim, even grimmer, surely, than a cat box, a happy hooligan, an easy go. He thought of war, he thought of plague, he thought of starvation. Then the painter goes down the ladder to pick up the gun and he's going to shoot himself, but he just doesn't have the nerve to do it.
And then he saw the telephone booth in the corner of the room. He went to it, dialed the well-remembered number, 2BR02B. Federal Bureau of Termination, said the very warm voice of a hostess. How soon could I get an appointment? He asked, speaking very carefully. We could probably fit you in late this afternoon, sir, she said. It might even be earlier if we get a cancellation. All right, said the painter. Fit me in, if you please. And he gave her his name, spelling it out. Thank you, sir, said the hostess. Your city thanks you, your country thanks you, your planet thanks you. But the deepest thanks of all is from future generations.
And that's the end of the story.
Yeah.
Again, unwanted consequences. You know, can we have a utopia or does that just defy science?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it gets back to questions we're seeing in science fiction a lot. I think of Omelas.
Yeah.
Does somebody have to suffer for the benefit of others? Is that just an unavoidable thing? And then, of course, on the other side of that, I think of The Miracle of the Lily, which we covered, where utopia was achieved and everybody was bored because life became meaningless and that was its own kind of existential hell.
Yeah.
And I imagine for an author who went through something like the firebombing of Dresden, remember, that's an Allied firebombing.
Yeah. That was his team.
That was the British and the American killing all of those people, and he would just happen to be on the ground. And when you have an experience like that, you must look at things and go, God, best intentions.
Yeah, or is it all worth it?
You could be on the right side of something and still do a terrible thing. And so you can try and make a good policy and still have it have horrible effects. I mean, it seems like light satire, but there's gun violence at the end of both of these stories.
Yeah.
They're deeply violent and about some pretty dark things, but funny at the same time.
Part of me too feels like looking at the war, and as you were saying in the story, that there is this world that is great, but it comes at a cost. And what is that cost? And is it worth it? And is the world worth it? And you know, it's a very existential question that's being asked here. And I think that you know, look at the firebombing that happened of Dresden. If that didn't happen, would the war still have continued longer than it should have with killing those people? You know, same question with Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
Yeah.
Did that save lives ultimately? Were those big picture decisions that were made for, you know, wrong for a means justifying an end?
It's one thing to have ideals, but when you're put in the driver's seat and you do have to make decisions, you quickly discover there are costs. There's nothing I can do to avoid it, you know? And I think that's the most difficult thing about leadership and setting policy and those types of positions.
Yeah. Some serious food for thought in this episode and these stories.
Well, I want to thank our patrons for making it possible for us to have these discussions and continue on with the show. I want to thank Safa Farhumand.
I want to thank Mark A. Messina.
I want to thank Tucker Snyder.
I want to thank Heather.
Brian Berg, thank you.
Michael Kent Cornett, thank you.
Opaline Illyria, thank you so much.
Samuel Bevan, thank you.
Marty Wilson, thank you.
And lastly, I want to thank Watts.
And of course, we want to thank our wonderful reader, Eric Peabody. Check him out on the Horror Hill podcast. And thank you, Eric, for all your contributions to our show as well. We'll have lots of links in the show notes for his stuff. Until next month, when we start in on Grimm Fairy Tales, we're going to have a bonus episode next week in which we're going to discuss something a little strange, wabi-sabi, which is an art philosophy, kind of a philosophy of life, and how it connects to weird fiction and the creative process. And I think that's going to be a lot of fun to talk about. That's going to fill the gap. And then in December, we'll be back with Grimm's Fairy Tales.
And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
If
If you don't like my kisses, honey, what will I do? I'll go see a girl in purple, kiss the sad world toodaloo. If you don't want my loving, why should I take up all this space? I'll go off this planet, let some sweet baby have my place.